This is a nice place you got here. But I have a question. What's behind the banner? No, I was warned ahead of time. But I do send you greetings from up in Los Angeles, also known as the Eagle Rock Church. This isn't warm here. I heard about 4 or 5 references to the heat. We just came from heat. You don't know heat. This is very nice. So I know you're very happy, and I congratulate you on your new building. We know that we're God's church only because, if nothing else, we're like the Jews that wander and wander from building to building. The last time that Victor and I, Mr. Howe and I, were together was, at about 7,000 feet? Victor, is that about right? And I'll tell you about that later. I wasn't even with my lovely wife. Now, if you see my wife, Becky, holding her right arm, she's had it in a sling up until just recently. She'd broken the top of her arm, and no, I had nothing to do with it. But anyway, that's why you see her favor her right arm a little bit. So we are both very happy to be here with you. She wasn't with me last Sabbath. She was back in Ohio. And in fact, Becky and I, to tell you the truth, we've never really gambled much. Not much anyway. Now, we do drive in Southern California freeways, which, as we just learned again today, neither the 5 or the 15 are safe. But God was good to us when we got here in one piece. So many people from Duluth would think that driving in Southern California is indeed gambling. But once I remember at a feast many, many years ago, and we were both very, very young, we went to Lake Tahoe for the feast. And we went with a group of other less savory church members to a local casino. We were up in Tahoe, North Shore, and we decided that we would do a little bit of gambling, or at least I decided. Becky was not in favor of it. She thought it was a tool of Satan the devil does today. And so we divided up our $10 or $20 all in pennies and dime slots. I said, honey, just take this bucket of money, take it over to the slots, and go have fun. It's just like going out to eat. She said, no, it's not. And off she went with her bucket. She was not happy. So she took her bucket of pennies and dimes and whatever she had, she went to the slots. And about 20 minutes later, she found me. She came back, empty bucket in hand, set it down, and raised both palms in the air and said, and they were black with the coins, right? She said, I have been defiled. We are never, ever doing this again. And we didn't. She didn't think it was fun. But there are plenty of people who do think it is fun. In fact, if you remember recently, the Powerball, I don't even know what Powerball is. That's what I thought, yeah. That's what I thought. $600 million. And we know of other lotteries from anywhere from $1 million to $10 to $20 to $100 million are given each and every year. California, after many, many years of negotiation with the state, finally went to gambling. And this message is not on gambling. But I wanted to let you know the National Endowment for Financial Education estimates that as many as 70% of the Americans who experience a sudden financial windfall will lose that money within just a few years. The news that you've read and I've read are legion of normal folks, everyday folks, usually in the Midwest, who win tens of millions of dollars and a few years later they're broke. I know from one newspaper, it's down in Texas, the Denison Forum, talked of one couple that won $2.7 million. Their marriage ended a few years later. A fire gutted their house and every penny of their fortune was gone. A man who had won $1.9 million spent it all and took a job at McDonald's flipping burgers. Another man won $16.2 million but filed for bankruptcy within a year and now lives on food stamps. But one I heard about, this happened just recently, was from a news station in Chicago. Ricardo Cesaro and his family had begun going through a hard time in the last couple of years. Last year, their 14-year-old daughter, Savannah, passed away suddenly from an illness. On February 12th, the couple, who have 3 children, stood before a judge in a foreclosure hearing for their home in the Mill Creek neighborhood of Geneva near Chicago. The judge gave the couple a few more months to find a new home, has the paperwork on their foreclosure finalized. 3 months later, the Cerezos decided to clean the kitchen, his wife did, including a shelf holding a clear glass cookie jar, which had been a gift from Savannah, their daughter, years before, stuffed with a couple of dollars in cash and some old lotto tickets. "Take them and get them checked or they're going in the trash," his wife said. Cerezo took the old tickets to the nearest gas station and scanned all 11. The first 9 were losers. The 10th won him $3. "I was pretty excited," he said. "Hey, this will pay for the Pepsi." But the last ticket he scanned told Cerezo that he needed to check his claim, and at the Illinois Lottery office in downtown Chicago, he was told he matched all 6 numbers. And on February 2nd, he won $4.9 million. What's the point to this? The point, go buy a lottery ticket? No, that's not my point. Hunt through old cookie jars? Possibly. That's up to you. The point is that many times we search for things in life, and we search and we search, and many times they're right in front of us, and we've never realized it. In fact, many of us, by evidence of you being here today, have been on a search, probably most of your life. It goes by many names, and different people will call it different things. Truth, the truth, God's truth. And these are terms that are familiar to us, but there is one phrase that has dominated the Church of God for decades, probably more than any other. It's gone in recent past to become almost a cliche, but it's still used by many. And that is the phrase, God's one and only true church. Where is it? And what does it look like? Recently, Mr. Howe and I had the opportunity to speak to a group of young adults. And I see one or two or maybe here. So last Sabbath, up in the beautiful area of Idlewild, we had some 40 to 50 young adults, including Victor, and I'm older than Victor, so I was the old man on the mountain. 18 to 32-year-olds in majority, they met for the weekend. We call these Generation Y, or the Millennials. And 3 of them in the audience were mine, so I know them very well. And I was to do, as last year, the Bible study. Mr. Howe had done the main message earlier. But I had asked the coordinators, one of which you know, Andrew Beatty, I had asked them, what's appropriate? Who were these kids? I knew many of them. The Millers were there, the Beattys were there, Roram, Fish, Garnet, many of them are from ER, from Eagle Rock, many from Northern California. So I knew many of them, but many of them I did not. The others, where are they from? Because as every speaker will tell you, you need to know your audience. Well, he said they're from 3 to 4 states. One's traveled 2 states, Utah, to get here just for this. They're all about 18 to 32. Some are married, and they represent 4 different, at least, maybe 5 to 6 different church groups. And I went, uh-oh, minefield. So I didn't want to offend. I asked my 3, Gen Y, what would be a good subject. I'm not allowed to tell you which one gave me most of my idea, but one of them said, discuss the groups, the different churches, that there is no one church. There maybe never was. Ask us what binds us together, why we're here for this weekend. To ask them what drives them crazy about their individual church. Ask them what do they like about the other groups. I said, great, thanks. Now I can be defrocked, de-eldered, decommissioned in one weekend. But worse, I could hurt and I could offend. So I chose the title, God's True Church. Where is it? Got to be here. To tell you the truth of my background, we learned a little about Victor that weekend because he gave us a little of his. So I'll give you a little of mine. I've been in 3 that I'll acknowledge, different organizations. I've been in 3 different organizations, and I said, indeed, on the first, it was the one and only true church. At least that's what they said they were. I was looking, as you were or are, for the truth, and a church that taught it. It was very simple. So I asked this group up in the mountains, I asked them, what would we know what to look for in this church? It's not like there's a sign spinner out there, or somebody said, one true church. arrow over here, park here. There is no sign that says God's one and only true church, enter here. And so we set it up interactively. I asked them how they would set it up. Essential doctrine, structure, and policy. So we interactively discussed, and it was very, very interesting in their reaction. We decided on an obvious set of central doctrines, the ones that were key, the ones that were important. Makeup is okay. Brown sugar only. Dress lengths will be checked. The important stuff. I'm kidding. Seriously, we arrived at these essentials, these doctrines very, very quickly. Very quickly. We discussed the difference between doctrine and teachings or policy. And all 40 of us agreed on 90% of the doctrines the United Church of God and other churches of God currently have. It took us, brethren, about 15 minutes. It wasn't that hard. And so structurally, we had a little bit more of an egalitarian model from the young ones. But you know, I wish I could cite to you right now the Bible where the doctrine, the structure, and the policy are all found in one section, where all this information of doctrine, structure, and policy are all in one section of your Bible. It ain't there. It doesn't exist. To do so today would require a number of Sabbaths with many biblical citations. It would need cross-referencing. It would need some word study, some knowledge of the Greek or the Hebrew to truly make the words of what we believe really make sense. But how is it, therefore, that 44, 45 adults, mainly younger, could agree on these issues so very quickly? How could that happen? How could that happen? Could it be that there is more to seeking out, quote unquote, God's true or God's true and only one true church? Possibly because we've used the word and the concept of church, possibly improperly. Now, let me be very clear with you. As the other gentleman here, I'm an ordained and credentialed minister or elder in the United Church of God. I have a card that says so. I carry it in my wallet with me all the time. And I was ordained in another organization, but I have credentials with United. United is where I want to be. It's where I feel I need to be. And thankfully, my family, my wife agree. It is where I find overwhelmingly positive biblical values with which I identify, and that's for me. I wish that all of God's people all over the world, that we all met together. Of course I do, just exactly as you do. Absolutely we do. But there sometimes is more to that. For some reason, we are all not in one church or in one building. And so if you would turn with me, not to a set of doctrines, but to a concept in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. It should be verses that are fairly familiar to you, but I'd like to read them. I'd like to read them possibly in a slightly different perspective. Take nothing away with what we've always thought, always taught, always believed, but maybe, possibly, just a slightly different angle. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 1, Paul speaks to the church at Corinth. And I'm always reminded when I read 1 and 2 Corinthians that many of the commentators believe that Corinth, because it was a trade route, it was a metropolitan area in the Greek world, that indeed it was a crossroads. It was a very, as they say, metropolitan area. In fact, one commentator called 1 and 2 Corinthians 1 and 2 Californians. If anybody could relate to Corinthians, it's those of us who live in Southern California. It was a very, very diverse place. And so as we read this, I want you to understand that what Paul is talking about, he's talking to a specific group of people in Corinth. Verse 1, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be ignorant. You know that you were Gentiles, carried away to these dumb idols. However, you were led. Therefore, I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God calls Jesus accursed, and no one can say that Jesus is Lord except by His Spirit." And you'll see him build up to the next few verses. Verse 4, "There are the diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are differences of ministries, but the same Lord. And there are diversities of activities, but it is the same God who works all in all. It's important about these spiritual gifts. He says there are many, but he enumerates three in particular. I don't know if you've noticed it. The word diversities is mentioned twice. If you have a translation like the New King James where it says diversities of gifts, there are differences of ministries, that word should be diversities. It's one of the few references in the New Testament to the New King James where it is the same word translated improperly. It should be diversities of ministries, but the same Lord. And there are diversities of activities. And so we have diversities of gifts, of ministries, and diversities. It's important. The word gifts is where we get the word charisma. And that's exactly the word. But it's the same spirit. The ministries, same ministries, but, and that's the word diakonia, which means where we get the word deacon. It means service, plain and simple. But it's the same Lord. And the word activities, the activities is the word where we get the word energy. It means the operations, things that operate within the confines of the assembly. But it's the same God. So we have a multiple of gifts. He's saying there are many, many gifts, as he'll enumerate in just a minute. He says, but also it is the same God who works all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healings by the same Spirit, to another working of miracles, to another prophecy, to another discerning of spirits, to another different types of tongues, to another interpretations of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually as He, which is God, as He wills. And so we see all these different gifts. They're all given to different individuals for different reasons. But they all are different kinds, but they're all from the same Spirit, distributing to each individual. But it profits all, everyone. So you can see a difference and an individuality, but there's a commonality. And Paul builds this theme throughout this chapter. He talks about diversity, but he's also going to talk about one in unity. But he uses a very, very interesting word over and over again, as we'll get to in a minute. And so we see in verse 7, it says these gifts are given, but the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. For the profit of all. The word profit there means to benefit, for the advantage of all. By one person's gifts, everyone benefits. Everyone profits. He then goes into the different gifts of wisdom, knowledge, faith, healings, miracles, prophecy, discernment, tongue speaking, and tongues interpreting. There's nine of them. Now, whether these are just the categories of the ministries alone, so there's 27, it's hard to say. The idea is there are many, many different gifts. There are a huge number of gifts that God can give individuals. And God decides who gets what. We do not decide. God decides who gives what. He uses then, in a teaching analogy, he uses in verse 12 this very interesting word. He says, for as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. The use of this word body is interesting, but he also uses a phrase, so also is Christ. He could have used a different word here. It would have been a great opportunity to use a different word. That word would be church. He could have very easily said, for as the body or the church is one, or as many members in that one body, so also is the church. But he didn't. He used the word as is Christ, the Messiah. Why did he use this word? This is an interesting word because there is distinction with the word body versus just a group. The word church is used only later, much later in this chapter, the word ecclesia, the ones that are called out as it relates to specific duties or offices. But Paul could have easily used the word church. He did not. Author Michelle Lee Paul, on her book, Paul and the Stoics, makes this comment. She says the phrase, "so it is with Christ," is unexpected and significant. As several commentators note, it would have been more logical for Paul to conclude with, quote, "so it is with the church," unquote. The reference to Christ in this area may be what's called metonymy, which means using something in representation for something else. If I said, well, that's just Hollywood for you, I would be referring to the film industry. That would be an example. And so he may be referring to the church, but he did not use it. She goes on. Still, why does Paul make this statement? The question is not whether Paul has the believers in mind. The "we" in verse 13 suggests that question, but why he refers to Christ and not the church directly at this point. If he had simply wanted to encourage cooperation, it would have been enough to apply the comparison in a generic fashion, as he will see in just a minute, because he uses another analogy. But let's use the words that he uses, "body." And so is Christ. So we are talking about Christ's body as this group of collected individuals. The body and its cognates are used some 18 times and mean literally a physical body. A physical body. Let's keep reading. In verse 13, "for by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body," this initiation. He says, "whether Jews or Greeks or whether slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit, for in fact the body is not one member, but many." This is important. He says, no matter who you are, this applies to us as well, no matter who you are, whether Greek, slaves, it doesn't matter, or Jews, whether you're from California, whether you're from Mexico, whether you're from Italy, even if you're from New York or Texas, you're considered part of the body. Not many, one. I'll tell you, give it an analogy by way of travel. I'm a native Californian. Second or third generation, we're not quite sure. And we lived for about 10, 11 years in New Jersey, all the way on the other coast. We were the only ones in our neighborhood that didn't have an accent. They figured out very quickly we were not from New Jersey. They knew we were from California pretty close, and that conversation went on for quite some time. But New Jersey is a different state. It has many things that California does not have. What those are don't really come to mind right now. I'm kidding. New Jersey is called the Garden State. How many of you have ever been to Newark Airport? There is a reason Newark Airport looks like that. They want you to get back on the plane and leave New Jersey. Because most of New Jersey is beautiful and it is a well-named state. Historically, we have nothing historic compared to New Jersey. And in many ways, culturally, we have nothing in comparison to New Jersey or the surrounding states of Pennsylvania and New York. It is truly a beautiful, beautiful part of the country. But we are all Americans, aren't we? You go to New Jersey, you're still an American. You come to California, you're still an American. The United States flag flies over. In fact, I see one in this room. We're all still Americans, no matter where we live in this country. Different? Different, but one. E pluribus unum is one, many out of one. And so we continue to read this very interesting analogy that Paul continues to use about the body. He says, verse 15, "if the foot should say of this body, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he has pleased." You notice the ending of that verse is very much like the ending of verse 11. Everyone is given a gift from the same Spirit, verse 11, individually as he wills. He ends verse 18, "he has set members, each one of them, in the body, just as he has pleased." It again reiterates the fact that God is in charge of what we do, how we do it, and who we are, and what we do within the body. This analogy was common of using body parts, as it were, using the human body as an analogy. Cicero did in his De Officiis, which is a tremendously important at the time, first century Roman work, he uses the body part. Epictetus, many of you have read Epictetus, he said is an analogy. He says, do you not know that the foot, if detached, will no longer be a foot? So you too, if detached, will no longer be a human being. So to use this typology, this analogy of the human body and its separate parts was very, very common during Paul's day. These parts, hand, ear, and eye, and the nose, which is referenced via smelling, are four of the six senses. They're very, very important to us. We need most of them in some degree to get around normally in life. These parts are also exposed. You can see my ears, you can see my nose, you can see my hand, you can see my eye. These are exposed. Paul uses other analogies here. The inference is not the loss of one of these, but separation. The head, interestingly enough, is not here. The head is not referred to. Paul does refer to the head itself of the body, who is whom? Jesus Christ. I'll reference 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, and Colossians 1:18. You can find it very easily in your Bible. Christ is the head. But what an interesting typology, no? To use the body. And I thought about this, and I said, a physical body. Why would he use a physical body? Well, A, it fits. It's a very good analogy. It will break down in time, as all analogies do. But it's an excellent, excellent analogy of the body of Christ. But I also thought possibly it would be a reminder to everyone who read this. Because there had to be everybody that read this that at least had an eye or an ear or a hand or a nose. They had to have one of those things. And this would be a reminder. It would be a constant reminder that we would ever say that, oh, that foot of mine, it has a mind of its own. I want to go right, but my foot wants to go left. And so possibly Paul wants us to remember. No one would say, has anybody seen my ear? Now, wives will say to husbands, where's your brain? But that's not the same. Mothers, of course, have eyes in the where? Oh, you've heard the saying. But all these analogies are useful. But Paul's here with the body. Why do we not see our hand or our ear or our eye or our nose? Why can we not see that they cannot exist separately? They cannot. They cannot be independent of our body. And so that's exactly what this is talking about. It's talking about independence versus dependence. All the parts of the body are dependent upon the body. Interdependent versus independent. None of the parts of the body can be independent. All of the parts of the body are interdependent. My hand needs my heart to function. My hand needs my liver. It needs my stomach. It needs my brain. It needs my eyes. My hand is borderline useless without my eyes. Sometimes it needs my nose. That's why we don't touch hot surfaces. We can smell them. That's something hot in front of us, even though we can't see it. So they're all interdependent. If our eyes and our ears and our nose and our mouth all worked exclusive of one another, it would be utter and complete chaos. And so is the body, and that body is Christ. What's interesting about this interdependent versus independent is the body suffers. The body will suffer. But you know what? The body will continue. And bodies do continue without an eye, without an ear, without an arm, without a leg. It will still continue, won't it? The body goes along, but the foot or the ear or the eye cannot. It cannot exist separately. It is dependent upon the body, not the other way around. So the body is Christ. We are not the body. The body is Christ. He still has not used the word church. There's no organization or fellowship which is a hand or a foot or an ear or the brain or the heart, especially if it acts independently. How can it? It's exactly what Paul is saying here. It is impossible because he has put the body together just as it says in verse 18, as he pleases. Verse 19, and if they were all one member, where would the body be? Now that's an interesting phrase. If they were all one member, where would the body be? It means that the body is diverse. The body is different. And it was designed to do something. Now, we are not talking about, lest your mind run to a fellowship or an organization or a church or a denomination that practices heresy. I'm talking to family here. Whoever you are, whatever your background is, for you to show up in this room on this day, at this time, with each other, means that we're family. I can look out and I know many of you have known for many, many years. So we talk today to family. So we're not talking about a group or a person that preaches outright heresy. But that's usually the issue, isn't it? It's usually the problem, isn't it? It's where the hand breaks away and the hand says, I'm the body. Or the eye breaks away and says, I can be separate. I can be the body. That's usually the case. I'm a hand and I'm so important, I can indeed function separately. Or I really am the heart and I can break away. So much so, I can see and smell and hear and touch on my own, though I was designed for something very specific. Verse 20, but now indeed there are many members, yet one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather those members of the body which seem to be weaker, are necessary. They seem to be weaker, but they are necessary. They are vital. We function better with two working eyes. We function better with two working ears. God designed our head and our eyes to have two ears, peripheral vision and peripheral hearing, with two hands so that we have a right and a left. That's the way it was designed. And those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on those we bestow greater honor. And our unpresentable parts have greater modesty. Those are the ones we cover up. But our presentable parts have no need. But God composed the body, having been given greater honor to that part which lacks it. It's an interesting phrase. Having given greater honor to that part which lacks it, that there should be no schism or separation or division of the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are the body of Christ, and members individually. And God has appointed these in the church, first time it's used, first apostles, prophets, teachers, after that miracles, healings, administrations, varieties of tongues. Are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, are all workers of miracles? Do all have gifts of healings? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? But earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. It's interesting, he talks about so many ideas here, and I would ask you to ponder some of these phrases that he uses. Because many times in the body, or can I say in the church at this point, we have an issue with many functions, weaker versus modest. Many functions in the churches are exposed. The function exposed. This is one of those functions. The speakers are exposed. You can see us. You can hear us. those of us that, I guess, have been doing it for a long time, realize the other people, like in the back, the people that set up the sound, the people that keep the room clean, the people that keep this wonderful fan going, that do the lights. Is that Mr. Weber's drums? Who put this building together? Do you realize you could function without the speaker, but you couldn't come together without this room? With the lights on, the rent paid, the food outside, those that have prepared it. Those things you don't see so much, and those things we sometimes don't elevate enough. Those things are considered less honorable. They're not. They're not weaker. We just keep them covered. We just keep them covered because of the function they perform. I think many times it would be better, indeed, if you did see more of the people that do put things so much together that have those gifts and those talents. We have some very, very talented people. In fact, you're first speaker is also helping with the sound. And so many gifts, diverse gifts, and that is the important thing. Paul gives us pause again to help us to understand that God, in verse 24, our presentable parts have no need, but God composed the body, having given greater honor to that part which lacks it. It says that God puts the body together the way He sees fit, not the way we see fit. In other words, the hand is the hand in the body because God designed it that way. It was as He willed. It also may give us an idea toward relational issues. One of the things that we talked about up in the mountains was that maybe this also tells us that we should be careful as to how we relate to other parts of the body, whoever they may be, wherever they may be. It is important to understand that. Too often, we are critical, not so much that the hand leaves the body, but that the foot criticizes the hand, or the hand just really doesn't like that eye, or that ear just doesn't quite appreciate that nose, because we don't understand it. First of all, we can't see it, therefore we do not understand it. But it may help us a little bit about relational issues. It was interesting that all these kids, I shouldn't call them kids, they're adults, that's why we call them, they're just young adults. It was amazing that all these young adults could come together in this one place and get along without any problem whatsoever for 3 days. 3 days. Try a group of elders from three different organizations together for 3 minutes, let alone there's some heads nodding. Yeah, sorry. But they did, and if they did, maybe we can. It may be relational, but it also may be a part of the lottery ticket that was there in the cookie jar. To go full circle, maybe what we have been looking for has always been right in front of us. It's always been there, and we really don't need to do anything about it, per se. Except take those things that we know that should make up God's church a part of what we believe. Is it more important for you what the other person believes or what you believe? Is it more important what you have been taught or what they have been taught? I think at the end of the day that God calls His people into judgment. He asks us to take Passover alone. The cup could be shared among us all, but each one of us must take that cup individually. Indeed, it is more important what you have been taught rather than what they have been taught or what I have been taught. It's more important that we take those characteristics of what we have been looking for and hope to find where we are and to make wherever we are a part of God's church because we are all a part of this one true body. Because there is only one body, and that body is of Jesus Christ. So indeed, we agree in the main on the vast section of doctrine. We agree when the Sabbath is. Other than that is commentary. But it is not a matter of where the one and only true church is, because we have found, through bitter disappointment, over 40 to 50 years, there is no one and only true church. There never was. But there is indeed a body, and all of us are a part of that body, which is Jesus Christ, who is the head.